town you never heard of.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Common Folk Podcast with Ben, Morgan, and Andy.
All right. Welcome back to Common Folk.
We're back.
It's been a minute for me. You guys did some recording without me.
Yeah,
did
last week. Me? Last week we went.
It probably really sucked too, huh?
Yeah, it was bad. Folks probably aren't looking forward to it.
I know. I am the show.
I haven't been able to shut up about it. I'm telling everybody about it.
Oh, like, great. So it was so good and I missed
it. They're like, oh, I can't wait to hear that one.
Well, people who are listening to this one would have probably heard it by now because it's probably the previous week. But it was a good one. We had fun out there.
Mm-hmm. I know. I was like, we're oddly sick. It was weird. Mm-hmm. It's fine in the morning for a second and then went south.
24-hour deal.
Yeah. Boom. So, you know, at least I didn't come around you guys and make you sick.
That's true.
So, Andy, you've been busy announcing football.
Yep.
I mean, basketball.
Basketball, yep. Just wrapped up our state tournament, girls and boys.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So, was that, like, do you like going away and doing that or is it, you exhausted?
It's both. Okay. But it's so much fun.
You do look forward to it every year.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's kind of like it's our big thing every year.
You need to post the picture of you guys in your jackets.
Okay,
flash that up on YouTube.
I'll get that over.
He looks so professional, guys.
Whoa. The gold ones.
Yeah, the gold ones. Jackets. I mean, it's like you kind of look like you won a golf jacket. Like you won
gold jacket,
green jacket. Instead of the green jacket.
Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
But that's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, it's kind of a throwback to ABC when they started Monday Night Football. You remember that Howard Cosell and those guys?
Mm-hmm. Oh.
They used to wear yellow jackets and it was just such an iconic thing. And when we got a new CEO, he wanted to like make a splash and make us more noticeable. So
that's
he
where
stuffed
it is.
Us in those jackets and to his credit, it's worked because everyone kind of says, I like jackets, whether they mean it or not.
Yeah.
It is very noticeable.
Yeah. No, so. I like it.
No?
Yeah. Heck yeah.
But it's not just us three today. We have a guest.
Yep. Guest today, back on the guest train, back in the studio. We are speaking with Doug McEnany. Got that right, right?
That's right.
All right.
Perfect. It's not an easy one to pronounce.
No, it's not. So keeping on brand with the whole Common Folk thing, met Doug and was kind of speaking with him about his background and what he's done in life, and it fit the mold for what we talk about. So local folks, mm-hmm. you know, small town type folks, Nebraska folks, Midwest folks, just kind of living that everyday life that we all do, and then going on to doing some pretty crazy stuff, some stuff that we can talk about and some stuff we can't. So we'll try to get into a little bit of it. But welcome, Doug. I would like to start with just kind of you kicking off, you know, where you grew up, what childhood was like, those kinds of things.
Well, thank you very much, Ben, mm-hmm. Andy, Morgan. It's great to be here.
And
I'll try not to screw this up for you.
Nah, you're good.
So my background is I grew up in a military family. So mm-hmm. my father was an Air Force pilot, and he kind of drug the family around the United States through pilot training and qualification and then ultimately through two air crew tours. He was a B-52 pilot, and that was during the height of the Cold War. So we had these bases spread around the world where B-52 aircraft crews were on alert because they had to be capable of getting in the air before potentially a missile could be launched to threaten the United States. So that was his life. When he finished crew training and crew qualification and then ultimately serving as a pilot during the Cold War, he was assigned to Offutt Air Force Base.
Okay.
So I was starting seventh grade when my family moved here.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. What age? Okay.
And the great thing about it was I was able to go from seventh to senior year in high school. And so I lived in a small town south of Omaha, Bellevue. Back then it was about 20,000 people, one high school.
So you're a chieftain?
Yeah, I'm a chieftain.
All right.
All right.
Well, that was probably even before there was the other high school, right?
That's right.
Okay, there was only one
Bellevue High School. So okay. Bellevue West was not even a figment of anybody's imagination at that point.
Okay.
So, same school I went to, by the way.
Yeah.
But at that time, there was two.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, back then, Bellevue High School was sort of a dominant force in the sports world.
Really?
In Nebraska, yeah. Usually, well, let's see. My junior year, they were state football champions. They never really had much of a basketball program.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure about why that was, but Bellevue East just never seemed to get the basketball thing going. But
that town and that school, when you were there, how much of it do you think was military?
Oh, better than half.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Bellevue was really the only option. There was no Papillion back in those days.
Yeah.
So then it was Omaha was your only other option?
Right.
For and, schools.
Yeah. So most people settled in Bellevue because of the obvious, obviously the commute. And, you know, that was a different world back then. I'm a pretty old guy. So, you know, nobody was driving 50 miles to work. That was unheard of in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Or even 20 miles to work, it would be like, what the hell's wrong with you?
Yeah.
So,
right.
So, yeah, and I grew up really, I would say I was a late bloomer. I spent most of my high school years hunting and fishing.
Hmm.
I wasn't really that interested in school. I had a job, working construction, and back then, Bellevue High School, because there were so many kids going to the high school, they couldn't – the school wasn't big enough to get everyone in at once. So my junior and senior year, I started really, really early in the morning, and I was done with school by noon, and then I'd go to work.
Oh.
But in the fall, I was a big pheasant hunter, duck hunter, not geese. We couldn't afford to hunt geese.
Steel shot.
Yeah. So
and all the blinds,
decoys.
Wait, trailer. But that's what I was going to say. What does that mean? That was too pricey?
Yeah, it was. You know, we hunted ducks on the Platte River. There wasn't a lot of geese on the Platte River, and you know, you had to have another set of decoys to hunt geese, and you had to kind of go about it in a different manner.
Okay.
So, I mean, we'd shoot at geese if they came close enough, but we were really hunting mallards.
Did pheasant hunting, was that local?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all up and down the eastern part of Nebraska. Probably we never went as far west as Lincoln, and the pheasant hunting was great back then. You know, you had to work for it, but there were plenty of pheasants.
Were you guys big on then processing the animals and eating that at home and those kinds of things as well?
Yeah. I mean, we, like most hunters, we weren't going to kill anything and we weren't going to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was pheasants. We didn't waste time on quail because they take you through a box of shells pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's not much to them.
Yeah.
So, but there was pretty significant quail population too. And then if a rabbit was unlucky enough to come by, we would harvest a rabbit. But
yeah. Was this you and, like, your friends or dad?
Yeah. No. This was me and my I started with my father.
Okay.
Before I could drive a car.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we were able to drive, it wasn't cool to have my dad along with me.
Right.
So,
I was out there with my buddies.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, I graduated from high school. I made a decision to go to the University of Nebraska. I was sort of working my way through a bachelor's degree program, changed my major two or three times along the way, ultimately decided to be an engineer. And the Navy got interested in me because I was on an engineering track. And I had a guy reach out to me sort of out of the blue and say, hey, how would you like to come talk to me? I may be able to offer you a scholarship. And I was kind of a poor college student. I was trying to make ends meet. My father was in the military, and there were two of us in college, so there wasn't a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I elected to accept a scholarship from the Navy, and I graduated as a civil engineer from the University of Nebraska, and then the Navy turned me into a nuclear engineer. So,
wow.
Yeah, so they have a very intense one-year program. Really, the only thing you need is a background in engineering, and they can turn you into a nuclear engineer. So that's what I spent the rest of my career in the Navy doing, 35 years in the Navy. My final assignment, operational assignment, was the commander of the submarine forces in the Pacific. So I had about between 50 and 60 submarines that were that I was overseeing the operation, the maintenance, and of those ships. About 8 ballistic missile submarines, the nuclear missile carrying submarines, and about 50 attack submarines.
No big deal. I mean, that's not that many.
Yeah.
Were you out in Saipan for a while then?
I've never been. Well, let me think about Saipan. No.
My dad got stationed out there. He was in the Air Force.
Yeah. No, I've been in Guam, which is probably not. I'm trying to remember now where Saipan is. It's in the Micronesia area. I just don't remember exactly where it's.
When him and his buddies get to talking, they do the whole Saipan.
Yeah.
we ran into a younger guy that just did his 4-year stint and got stationed out there. And Dad asked me, he goes, oh, yeah, Saipan. Yeah.
Well, when your dad was out there, it was probably a different place, back then.
Yeah. It was during the Cold War.
Yeah. The world's kind of caught up with places like that. It wasn't easy to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people were there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sort of promotes this camaraderie for the people stationed there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably a bar or two out in town that caters to your father and his buddies. So that would be my guess.
Yeah, I think
I haven't been there, but
I think you're about right.
I think I know the place.
So when you came out of college, then you went in and you did that 1 year of the nuclear engineering school you were talking about, right?
Yeah, right after I was commissioned. Yeah.
Okay. And so then where did it go from there? At that point, do you get like an assignment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was assigned to my first submarine, which was based in Groton, Connecticut, which is southeastern Connecticut, right on the water. I was on that ship I've already made a mistake here. We're not allowed to. Generally, submariners don't call them ships. They call them boats.
Okay.
But, who cares?
why would you call it a boat?
It is a ship. It goes back to the early days of submarines where they wanted to be referred to as boats.
Okay.
And they wanted that to stick. And, you'll run into some submariners who will, correct you. I'm not one of them.
Okay, because it doesn't.
Yeah.
Tomato, tomato, like that.
Yeah.
Whatever.
It's just the way it is. But I was on that boat for 3.5 years. And then usually between every sea intensive assignment, you're given a chance to rotate to what we call shore duty, which is admin, sort of, supporting the service, whatever they ask you to do. But the thing is, you go home every night. On a submarine, because the ship has to be manned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we have duty sections. And once you get assigned to a duty section, depending on the rotation you're in, 1 in 3 or 1 in 4, so if you're 1 in 3, which is what I was in for most of my junior officer tour on the submarine, every third day I'm sleeping on board and not allowed to leave the ship. That only applies, of course, in port. At sea, everybody gets to sleep on board and not go home.
So the sh- let me get this right. So the ship would just be
the boat
would be on just shore, but you have to work on it, and it's just parked.
Yeah, it's at the pier. Okay, and if you're in the duty section, you come in the morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you don't go home the next day until at probably not before noon. And if you're an officer on the ship, you work the full day the next day.
So when would it go out to sea? When you need to, when there's war, or like when you guys have to run a mission, or?
No, that's a good question. It the op tempo, as we call it, we try and maintain at 50%, which means that 180 some days a year you're at sea. The other 180 days a year you're in port, tied up to the pier, which means, you know, you're available to your family. Okay.
Okay.
If you're in the duty section, you're only available to your family like 2/3 of that time in port.
I see.
So you can understand why some people just, they choose not to follow that path for the rest of their career. They do one tour and they say, and the Navy allows you to get out of the Navy and move on to whatever it is you're attracted to.
When you're at port, is it like the submarine is sitting there just kind of like surfaced, like you can see the top of it or whatever, and it's just kind of parked right there?
Yeah, the submarine is surrounded by ballast tanks, okay, and you can either flood the ballast tank with water or push air into it and push the water out. Mm. And so when you're on the surface, the ballast tanks are full of air.
Gotcha.
And, you know, we do a pretty careful job of monitoring what we call the draft of the submarine, both fore and aft. So you look at and there are markings on the submarine that tell how deep it is below the keel, you know, from the keel up to that marking. Mm-hmm. And there's a watchstander assigned to take those draft readings frequently to make sure that, because you might not know it, you could be losing air out of one of the ballast tanks. Mm-hmm. And that would cause the submarine to start sinking slowly. Bad for your career if it sinks at the pier.
Oh, please tell me that's not happened.
It has happened.
But not on your watch.
But very, very, very infrequently.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like
and there was, I mean, I'll give you a kind of an interesting story. There was a submarine in Charleston, South Carolina many years ago that was incapable of getting underway because of the maintenance that was being performed on the ship. And a hurricane, Hurricane Hugo, came through, and the CO elected to submerge the submarine next to the pier. So he put the submarine on the bottom, a kind of a soft landing because the bottom was soft. And he was underwater while that hurricane came over and probably prevented significant damage from his submarine. Hmm. He didn't put it on the bottom without a lot of approvals, but ultimately it was decided he would be better off sitting on the bottom. The other submarines in that port got underway to avoid the hurricane. He didn't have that option.
Interesting.
So how quick can a boat, like, go out to sea? Like, if it needs to go, how long does it take to get everything ready?
Well, it varies.
Okay, on the size and shape or where it's sitting or how it is.
So the first thing you have to do is make sure that everything's ready to go. And there's some pretty extensive work that's done to prepare the ship to go to sea.
Okay.
And that work is usually started 2 days before the submarine gets underway.
Oh, wow.
And it's a series. It's what we refer to as pre-underway checklists, and we systematically go through the submarine to make sure it's ready to go. And once you get through that, you know, it's not trivial to start up the reactor on a nuclear submarine. So in an emergency, it can be done quickly, but we generally don't like to do it that way because it involves risk that we'd rather not take. And as a young officer and an engineer, when we started up the reactor, you'd back up 4 hours from the underway time, okay? And so if we were getting underway at 8 o'clock in the morning, I was doing a pre-shift brief in the crew's mess as engineer at 3 o'clock in the morning, stationing all the watchstanders.
Okay.
And I wanted to be started on the reactor startup by 4 hours prior to underway. And that what that means is the reactor is what we call self-sustaining. So you get to a point where everything's operating. There's big turbine generators, 2 megawatt turbine generators on the ship I was engineer on. There's two of them. And the propulsion turbines are driven by steam. So you need to be at a point where the reactor is generating enough heat to produce steam and keep all that equipment running.
It's like mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, it's kind
of
cool.
I just keep thinking of the game Battleship.
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's not as fast as a lot of people. You know, if you're on a surface ship with gas turbines, you can be underway lickety-split.
Yeah.
But on a submarine, it's a little more exhaustive process.
So you said your first assignment was like 3.5 years or something like that. So what happened in that time frame that I guess got you hooked, or did you just not have a choice? You had to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Well, you know, every young officer starts off getting qualified. Mm-hmm. So there's a series of actions. You gotta qualify as what's referred to as the engineering officer of the watch. That's the lead supervisor for the reactor plant. So that's a must. That generally takes, depending on the individual, 0 to 6 months. Not zero, but we do have some guys who go to college having already served on a submarine, and they come back and they get it done really fast.
Sure.
Because they know what you know what they're doing, and they've been exposed to it before. After you qualify engineering officer of the watch, as an officer, then you have to qualify officer of the deck. So for most of the officers in the Navy, that's a 2-year process. So, you know, they refer to you as an I probably shouldn't say this, but a worthless oxygen-sucking individual until you're fully qualified.
Right. You got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Taking up space.
And we'll move you up to maggots.
Yeah. Eating my food, not contributing in the manner that I need you to. Mm-hmm. And so it's 2 to 3, depending on the operations of the submarine, can be as long as 3 years, too. For me, it was 2 years. And then my 3.5 year tour on my first submarine, I spent 2 years in a non-refueling overhaul. So we were modernizing the ship, and I was still standing watch every third day, but in the shipyard.
Okay.
And it was the submarine was in a dry dock with big, gigantic holes cut in the side of it. They cut through the pressure hull, and they take, you know, all manner of equipment off the ship. They refurbish it, and then they bring it back and put it back on the ship.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty amazing to see. And I came along at a time when we were going from analog combat systems to digital combat systems. So I started off with an analog ship, went through overhaul, came out with a digital ship.
Was it just night and day different?
Oh, just an amazing difference.
Yeah.
It was better.
From capability, oh, yeah, so much better. Mm-hmm. You had a few people that complained, but
sure.
I was a weapons officer when we left overhaul, and so I was afforded the chance to receive all this digital combat training, which I just ate up. I thought it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the weapons officer is responsible for the torpedo men, the sonar operators, the fire control technicians, and the sonar operators and fire control technicians benefited from that digital upgrade. They loved it. So,
sure.
But, you know, that's one thing about, you know, that I'm proud about in the submarine force. We, you know, we have a submarine, the life of the submarine typically between 30 and 40 years, but it what it ends up looking like at the end of 4 years and what it was when it was commissioned, night and day difference in terms of capability and you know, the equipment that's loaded on board. We're constantly in a refresh mode.
I bet, because there's just always new technology.
That's right. That's right. And it gets better and better and better.
So is it cheaper to refurbish than to just build from scratch a new sub?
Well, new subs, you know, the really expensive part of a new submarine, I would say, is the mechanical systems. And they get upgraded too, but not to the degree that the combat system gets upgraded.
Okay.
So it's, you know, like when I was a young, brand new officer on a submarine, we didn't have any satellite navigation. So when I joined the Navy, there was no GPS. There was.
So you're just following a map?
No, we had what's called LORAN navigation, which is a low-frequency transmitter arrayed around the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean, and you would get a bearing to that low-frequency transmitter, and you need three bearings to get a fix. And then, you know, it took a lot of time. It took a lot of, you know, submarines don't like to be at periscope depth. You have to raise an antenna out of the water to do that. You're vulnerable.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes there's clouds out so you can't see the stars.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I never did a celestial fix, so I can't speak to that. Yeah, no. I mean, Lorraine Charlie was pretty good, and the reason is you've got to know where you're at, because a submarine could potentially hit the bottom. We have fathometers, but you know, we go at pretty high rates of speed under the water, and the last thing in the world you want to do is run into something. It's really bad for your career. And the crew gets a little confidence problem in the CO when he hits the bottom.
Oh.
Did you guys ever in your career have any scenarios like that with any kind of like an accident or
bumping into
something?
Well, you mean in the submarine force?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had some spectacular ones.
Really?
Yeah. You should go Google the USS San Francisco. I think it was 2000 and – let me think about this. 2004, they were transiting from Guam to Australia, and they hit a seamount at a very, very high rate of speed.
What's that?
It's a underwater mountain.
That's a sea mountain. I got you. Okay.
We call them seamounts.
Okay.
But you're right. It's sea mountain. And it's really a mountain underwater, right? Mm-hmm. It rose up to a height that was basically high enough, but still underwater for the submarine at the depth it was operating at to hit it top speed. Mm. And it killed one of the sailors back in the engine room.
Oh my goodness.
The ship stopped so fast that, you know, that he slammed into a vertical surface and fractured his skull, and they couldn't get him off fast enough, and he died.
What are those – and I know there's, like, knots and whatever kind of thing when you talk about speed, but how fast are they going, like, in a speed that we're used to hearing, like, a mile per hour or something like that?
So I think the unclassified answer, Ben, is greater than 20 knots, which is – about between closer to 25 than it is 20.
Okay.
Which doesn't seem very fast, but
you got that big of a piece of machinery moving at that speed. That's
7,000 ton submarine going 25 miles an hour. You're not going to stop it very fast.
Yeah.
Well, a mountain will.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. So how many people would maybe be on your boat?
So an attack submarine has about 130 assigned. You don't always take everyone when you go to sea. So we try and make sure that everybody has a place to sleep. Unfortunately, there aren't enough bunks on board for everybody to have their own bunk. So
people bunk together?
Yeah, they have.
Really? There you go.
No. They're not in the bunk at the same time.
They're doing watch rotations.
One guy's sleeping, the other guy's on watch, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
That reminds me of some folks have an orange cone theory. You know how those construction cones that are just everywhere all year round? Since the Department of Roads doesn't have a place to put them, they just keep moving the construction sites. So rather than, okay, we're done here, let's put away all the orange cones. No, just move them to that road, you know, so they're always kind of working. They're always out there. So,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. So just kind of that principle.
Move them around.
Yeah. And, only the most junior sailors have to deal with that. Once you're qualified in submarines, you're not an oxygen sucking, food eating.
Nobody.
Hey, yeah. That's how it is everywhere in life. Yeah. Like when I was a, redshirt freshman playing football, I had to share a locker. That's what the freshman got, the back of the locker room, the stinky part of the locker room.
Get in the back of the bus.
Get in where you fit in.
That's what a lot of people got to realize, and they got to go through. Like that's a rite of passage in life with a lot of those kinds of things. And too many people get in those kinds of scenarios and are like, "Screw this! I'm not doing this. I'm better than this or whatever." Yeah. And then they miss out on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. And who do you think you are? Like, I remember you'd walk by the seniors, and they were all so cool, but they're all preseason All Americans, all conference players, and things like that. And I think back to my day. I'm going off on a tangent here, but those are some of the funnest days of college. It was me and the rugrats, whatever you want to call us, oxygen sucking, worthless, about to get cut. I mean, that was just fun every day back there in our little locker room and, just bonding, I guess.
Right. So. I'm sure there's some story. I mean, I'm sure all the Navy guys have so many stories.
Yeah. It's sort of a rite of passage.
Yeah.
We're going to plumb the depths of your commitment to this.
Absolutely.
You got people watching all the time. So it's not like it's more of a psychological thing than anything else. There's no physical abuse or anything.
Yeah.
It's not. Not that it hasn't happened, but it's not tolerated. If it's discovered, you're finished.
You're gone.
I want to ask a quick question. I won't spend too much time on it, but like mechanically, I always love how the mechanics work on things. So you were talking about these subs being nuclear powered. First of all, some of them aren't, right? Yeah, or are they all nuclear powered?
Yeah, we don't have any non-nuclear submarines.
Okay, so they all are. Okay.
Every one of them now.
So how does that work exactly? Is that similar to like a power plant where like the nuclear reaction is just creating heat to move steam and turn things?
Yeah, very simply, the fission process, which is controlled by that guy I told you, the engineering officer of the watch earlier, generates heat. And that heat has to be removed in order to prevent the fuel cells from melting, It's done at very, very high temperature and very, very high pressure. Unlike any pressure, maybe your engine temperature at times. I wouldn't recommend running your engine at the temperature that the reactor operates at. And what happens is that in order to keep that coolant, which is cooling the core from from releasing steam, we don't want it to steam.
Okay.
Okay. So, you put a pot of water on the stove, take it up to 212 degrees, and it's going to release steam. But if you did the same thing under pressure, it would take a lot more higher temperature for the steam to form. So that coolant gets at a very, very high temperature. You run it through a steam generator, and the steam generator has what we call primary side and the secondary side. The secondary side is water that's at very low pressure. So as the – and that water cools the reactor coolant. And what it does in the process is it causes steam to form, and that steam is sent to an engine room where it drives gigantic turbines that create – and propulsion turbines. So generally two of each, two propulsion turbines, two electrical turbines.
Okay.
And they create all the electrical energy you need on a submarine and all the propulsion power you need to push it through the water.
So the propulsion turbines are being spun by the steam power?
Correct.
Okay, not by electrical power.
Right. And then in the process, you remove so much energy from that steam, it condenses and it turns into water again, and you just pump that water right back into the steam generator.
There you go.
Wow.
Pretty efficient.
So that's just, interesting. Yeah.
Cycles. So, and what kind of caught my ear when you were talking about it earlier, you were saying, you know, when Morgan asked her question, like, how long does it take to get out to sea? And you said, you know, 4 days prior, we're going to fire up those reactors, you know, get things going, whatever. What is it about that system compared to what we hear about in like power plants where they say, you know, you can't just shut these things off and turn them back on? Like it's almost like a never ending reaction. Right. So what is it different about the submarines where you kind of shut them off and turn them on?
Yeah. So commercial power is different in many respects from the nuclear power we use aboard ships. I say one of the fundamental differences is those reactors are boiling water reactors.
Okay.
So they actually allow the coolant to boil.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is that there are entrained radioisotopes in the steam that's used to drive the turbines that they use to generate electrical power. We don't want that on a submarine. We don't want any radioisotopes in the coolant or outside the coolant, which is contained in what we call the primary system.
Hmm.
So the secondary system is not contaminated. We don't want it to be contaminated. And there's sound reasons for that. A commercial nuclear plant, they're really out there to make money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they have to operate constantly in order to make money selling the electrical energy that's produced. So they're constantly operated at extremely high power, 100% power.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time they generally shut down those plants are for trouble and to refuel. And it, you know, the fuel gets used up pretty quick. Relative to a submarine, you know, you think about a submarine, the core that we put in submarines today lasts the life of the ship. So you put a core in there and it's good for 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Not so with the commercial nuclear industry. We used enriched uranium. They used very low-grade uranium.
Mm.
But it's effective in what it does. And like you said, Ben, it's operated at really high power and for long periods of time because that's what is needed in the commercial nuclear industry. Mm-hmm. They got to make money. They don't have a choice. So that's how you operate those plants and how they were designed.
Yeah.
It just seems like efficiency and money could meet somewhere.
But yeah.
I guess, you know, we'll leave it there.
Well, when it and also when it comes to the military, I think that that's less of the objective. I mean, it's more to be ready and effective, not to necessarily like save money or whatever.
But that's right.
I would still like society to kind of mirror that. Like, hey, maybe let's be a little bit more efficient, not worry about, you know.
No, being they at 100%. Want to spend your money. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I know
what you're saying.
I know. Yeah.
I'm not
I got it.
Andy, I'm not sure they'd be in business very long.
I know.
That approach.
I know.
That's the problem.
Yep.
That's the problem.
Is it true? Maybe you know this. I heard first real light bulb ever invented had a lifespan of like 200 years, and they right away they're like, "Well, this isn't going to work. We'll never sell another light bulb." So they had to
they changed it.
Yeah, they had to re-engineer it and dumb it down and make sure it would burn out in about a week or so.
Stop.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be true.
Have you ever heard that urban legend?
No, I haven't. Yeah. That's a first for me.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I don't think you'd want to be reading by the first light bulb ever created, though. I just, you know, they say
sending some stuff out.
Yeah, Edison, you know, on the way to creating the light bulb, you know, I don't know, he's got some famous saying about failure is just another way to train yourself to do it right eventually.
Mm.
So he failed a lot, but yeah, that first light bulb probably wasn't very good.
No, okay.
Yeah, I imagine. So we've only talked about just a little snippet there of the beginning of your career in the Navy. So from there, I mean, obviously you went on for another 30 plus years.
Right.
What was kind of next for you, and what are some of the high points in your memory?
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, I'm not a real nostalgic individual, but looking back on it, I think, 35 years is a long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there were some definite highs and some definite lows. But what was great about my career was the highs greatly outnumbered the lows. I'm not going to lie to you. I worked for some people during my 35-year career that I don't have a lot of respect for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But, you know, one thing about a naval officer and really the military is you got to learn to adapt. You got to learn to get along with just about anybody, even the assholes,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
And, it's just what it is.
Yep.
And so I was in a position where I generally had a lot of people working for me. Even as a young officer on a submarine, you know, I had a division of – 25 guys. So I always felt like, my attitude was, if you're on my team, I got your back.
Mm-hmm.
And, working for somebody that was difficult to work for, I tried to be the shield between them and the difficult individual. That wasn't always fun, but, it is what it is. The military was a lot different when I joined as a young man. It was, I wouldn't say the military was necessarily interested in how you felt as an individual. It was mm-hmm. during the Cold War,
yeah,
which was a tough time for our country. And it was like, you're going to do it my way and mm-hmm. I'm not really interested in your psyche and how you feel.
Right.
Yeah. Get over it.
Yep. Yep. I really like that point because we're so conditioned now to think, oh, it's the worst it's ever been. And, mm-hmm. and we got this guy over here and we got the guy over there. And we got to be worried about and scared about. Man, you get like, no, we've always had something going on. Something's yep. always been cooking. This isn't something new where, oh, we have this threat from overseas. No. Like, and it was really, really tense.
That yeah.
things, when we decided like, okay, this is how things are going to be run now. And some folks over there are like, I think maybe we should do it this way. No. We won the war. Well, so did we.
Yeah.
And then the Cold War just right away, boom. And then right away, well, we have these weapons, you have those weapons, and we're pointing them at each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like that was way more intense than the way we've had it since the yeah. wall went down and all that stuff. Like, and you were in the middle of it.
Right.
You were in a submarine.
Like, well, but that those are all great points, Andy. And what I would say is, but we didn't get it 100% right either. Like, I'll give you an example. When I was my entire career in the submarine force, it was a single gender submarine force, males only. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We went through this awakening in the military where, there was a little bit of conceit, I would say, by, was it largely a male run organization and, mm-hmm. oh, they can't do that. Or there was always something, well, what if they get taken prisoner? And, this is hypothetically speaking, women serving. It took a long time for yeah. us to reach a point where we embraced women,
yeah.
and the submarine force, that's occurred in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some amazing women now serving aboard our ships, not worried about the fact that, it's kind of a confined little space and
yeah.
you might see me coming out of the shower with a towel on and it's like,
yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, come on.
So you guys don't have any furries on board yet?
Any
furries?
He's probably not familiar with furries. That's a more modern kid thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's everywhere. No, these are people that identify as like
as
foxes,
animals at school.
And foxes and
so
stuff
the teachers
like
can just like they can respond and they have to bark, or if they're a dog, they can just
meow.
They
have litter boxes at some of these high schools.
Like,
litter
this boxes. Is not a joke, Doug.
Okay, well, you don't want to take me down that rabbit hole.
So there's no furries on, there were not on his ship.
Oh, man, I thought we were so progressive.
When we talk to people, you actually talk back. You don't chirp or
yikes.
Meow.
I'm not going to say anything.
So what do you think about, like, in that arena? We keep hearing this narrative that the military is having a really hard time recruiting folks, and there's a lot of folks that just don't want to be a part of it. Why do you think that is the way it is today? Like, is that part of what we're talking about here, you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of really good reasons why. So, you know, you think about the United States, we're north of 350 million, working our way towards 400 million people. And if you look at the military as a service, all the branches of the military, it's like 1% of the total population mm-hmm. of the United States. So I think most people have family or know someone that served in the military. I do think that COVID really this problem that you refer to, Ben, is really a new problem. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the Navy, it's the Army, it's the Air Force. They're all having trouble recruiting right now. And I think a lot of it is COVID-related, maybe not all of it. But we've been through this before. There were periods of time when I served in the Navy, we just forget about these things.
Mm. Where, you remember times.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, where we couldn't man our submarines because we couldn't recruit enough people to man them. And, we figured it out, and I'm pretty confident we're going to figure it out again. We're going through sort of a dip in our ability to recruit day to day. And that's a problem that you live with for the next 25 years because when you have these periods where you don't make mm-hmm. your recruiting numbers, that cohort class moves through the whatever branch of the military it is, and mm-hmm. they're never manned right. You can't make it up.
Right.
So there's no going back. Mm-hmm. There's no, because we don't bring people in with 15 years of experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We bring them in with no experience and we train them to do the job.
So what's the answer? Like, what happened? Just time?
Yeah, it's going to be a wound that isn't going to heal and it's going to work its way through the military. But it's not, I would say, that debilitating. Like I said, we've worked through this before. Mm-hmm. We'll figure it out. We'll come up with ways to mitigate the effect it's having.
So you don't think throwing money at it?
Oh, money's definitely going to get thrown at it. And, you know, there's a lot of people who say, well, money, you know, it's not enough money to matter. That's not true. Money mm-hmm. always changes yeah. people's minds.
No, we'll agree. We'll get back to, you know, male, female, not worry about furries if there's enough money involved.
Yeah. I just didn't know if they would, you know, do like big signing bonuses. And
they will.
So, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. The Congress won't allow the military services to be in a position where they can't recruit the people they need. They'll start adding money to the recruiting budget so that you can attract more men and women to join.
Yeah.
So, like, and this is kind of a problem that seems to always be a thing too, like, oh, our military is not big enough, it's not robust enough, we need more numbers. And I can remember in the early 2000s the Navy was really trying to get some recruits, and they came out with this awesome ad campaign, and it featured Godsmack, you know, that band. You know, oh man, it was just so intense, missiles flying and people running across the deck and doing cool stuff. And it was, they totally botched it. The marketing campaign was awesome. So all these kids, you know, got off their BMX motocrosses and I'm going to go to Navy, brah. And then they get there like, all right, scrub the deck. And it was so boring. Like, well, this isn't what I signed up for. The ad campaign.
They
like,
missed it.
They missed it. Yeah, it was too good. Like, it sold a bill of goods that just wasn't quite ready for them yet.
I feel like that's also, you know, you hear over and over that, that saying of like the, you know, tough times create strong men, strong men create
easy times.
Yeah, and then the easy times create weak men, and you know, and then weak men create tough times. Yeah, on and on. What Doug was talking about early on, you know, where you have all these guys coming in, and you know, you've got to pay your dues, you've got to put in your years, you've got to grind it out. You've got to answer to people. Like, those are the tough men.
Got
to
get along with assholes.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
And creating, you know, the good times. And then you have those good times. And then you've got all these kids, like what you're talking about there, where they're like, yeah, I don't want to do that. Yeah.
Or you have people that are like, I need to speak to HR. I didn't like how my neighbor looked at me. You know, like just big whiners. Like, get over it and work.
I kind of feel like we're coming around.
Maybe he's HR. That'd be good.
We're coming around that right now, where we've got a large population, a large percentage of the population as these weak men. And we say men, but it's people in general anymore, that don't want to do the hard things.
No.
But it's created this hard time, you know, so to speak, and we're starting to see stronger folks come out of that.
Yeah,
and I think that's starting to come back right now.
Okay.
I guess what I would say is, you know, don't underestimate the capability of the young men and women today. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to rise to the challenge. They're going to get it done. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have all this Gen X and Gen Y.
Right.
I don't have a lot of time or patience for, you know, this aggregating, you know, a certain group of individuals.
Yeah, yeah. And yes.
They're not as good as we were when we were their age. They're all terrific. And all you have to do is spend a little time on a submarine to see what America's best provides in terms of capability.
Yeah.
I mean, these are eye-watering talent. And, you know, on a submarine, the average age is like 22.
Mm. Wow, okay? That's so young.
Yeah, so, you know, you don't see any old people. I left submarining at age 42. I was way too, you know, I had gotten to a point where I could see I was limiting.
Get out of here, Grandpa.
Yeah, and the guy that replaced me was like 38, okay? And the CO is always the oldest person on the submarine generally. And so at 42, I was the oldest guy, and I was surrounded by all these kids who were just amazing.
Mm-hmm. When you left the submarines, you stayed in the military longer?
Yeah, I just wasn't going to sea anymore. I did my sea time on four different submarines. Resulted in underway time for me of 13 years of my life.
Mm.
So 13 years of my life was spent plying the seas of the world.
Underwater, basically.
Yeah, most of the time.
Yeah,
we don't like submarines on top of the water. Yeah. We want them submerged.
Yeah.
13 years of your life underwater. That's crazy to kind of wrap your head around and think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was over about a 22-year period, but
yeah, especially with like family, that would be hard.
Yeah,
you know, and kids and stuff. Yeah,
yeah, and let me correct myself. I was assigned to a submarine for 13 years, so my underway time was about a little over half of that. So 7 years submerged. Mm-hmm. Think about that.
Oh my God!
And you know, you ask. Wow. You know, a lot of times people ask me, well, what was the longest time you ever spent? Which is a great question. And I certainly don't have the record, not even close to the record, but 77 days straight at sea underwater. And just imagine the four of us doing podcasts for 77 straight days. You'd be sick of me.
Oh, yeah.
By the end of 77 days.
How did they even, like, that brings up so many questions that we don't have time for, but how do they even have enough food?
That's a great question. It's frequently asked. It's the limiting factor, okay? It dictates how long you can stay at sea. And so, and if you think about it, we are literally walking on top of food. So we put the food in all the passageways, and you're eating your way to a point where you're not walking on food, and then you've got a bunch of other places to store it. But think about feeding 120 people four square meals a day, because you got breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then you got to feed guys that come off watch in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And that's called mid-rats, which is basically all the food that didn't get eaten in the previous day goes out on the sideboard and everybody.
That would be another thing of like no waste. Like you're not throwing away anything. Mm-hmm. All of this stuff's
eaten. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And
fourth meal is the leftovers.
That's right. Every day. A lot of guys love that too. You know,
it doesn't matter if somebody's already taking a bite out of whatever that is.
No. We don't make them eat somebody took a bite out. All right. It's you know, we prepare more food than can be eaten, and then we just take what's left over and
reheat it.
Yeah, we put it in the refrigerator and we break it out at night and feed the crew, the part of the crew, which is about a quarter of the crew, between 30 and 40 people who come off watch at midnight.
Okay, is there like a captain?
Captain of the ship?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, that's that was
what. Were you guys like buddies or did you like some, like you liked some of them, you didn't like some? Did you have to work like right by them? That's
no.
Who you, oh, okay. So you weren't in like that area.
Are you talking about like Pirates of the Caribbean or something?
No, like I know he's captain, not like that captain, like, but there's somebody driving the sub. Yeah,
there is a captain. He's, you know, he is uniquely responsible for the safety of the ship.
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
So it doesn't matter who screws it up, it's his fault, okay?
But he's not really driving.
No. The captain doesn't drive. The captain is there to preside.
Okay.
And make sure the ship is being operated to peak effectiveness and safely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that is the best job.
Was that the cush
on
job?
The face of the earth.
Why?
I used to get up every morning and look at myself in the mirror and remark to myself, Jesus, Doug, they're paying you to do this. That's how much fun it was.
Okay.
You know, because I enjoyed the hell out of it and I felt totally prepared to execute those duties. And I had a very, very successful ship.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it's sort of this whole idea, success breeds success.
Mm-hmm.
I took over a ship that was coming out of the shipyard. You know, my first major inspection in command didn't go very well. But nobody expected it to. We knew it wasn't going to go very well because the crew wasn't used to operating the submarine. So it took a little while to get them up to speed. And, you know, I remember telling my crew on the pier after the inspection was over and everybody was really disappointed and they were hanging their heads. I said, listen, guys, this isn't your problem. This is my problem. This is a coaching problem. I'll fix it. And we did, and we were extremely successful as a crew. And then what you have is everybody wants to come to your ship. Of course, you can't take them, but they all want to come to your ship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that kind of leads into the next part of your career, I think, because, you know, you went in as an engineer.
Right.
And, you know, you're an expert in all these moving pieces and systems and how things work and so on and so forth. But then what you talked about there is more of a leadership role rather than that engineering role.
Right.
So is that when, obviously you were a leader when you were on the subs, but then once you left that, then did your career go kind of more towards leadership?
And? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, it was after I left command, I came to STRATCOM. I served in a capacity at STRATCOM where I was responsible for the strategic weapons system that produced the nuclear war plant. We called it SWIPS. And so, you know, you talk about a situation where I certainly didn't know enough, but I had all these scientists that worked for me who were building a mainframe computer it was mainframe. We were going from mainframe to open architecture. So I supervised the transition, but I had some amazing people working for me doing that. And what that did was that facilitated a process where the nuclear war plan could be manipulated in a way that was more – it provided more flexibility to the wartime commander. Mm. So I had nothing in my career that prepared me for that other than I had – you know, I was known to be a good leader. I was put in that position. I learned a lot. And then to your question, Ben, I went from that job to another shore assignment, much to my chagrin, because I wanted to go back to the waterfront. I did that job, learned a lot more, and then I took command of a squadron on the West Coast in San Diego where I had 10 nuclear submarines in my squadron, and I was what's called the squadron commander, often referred to as the Commodore.
Okay.
And my job was to man, train, and equip those submarines to conduct whatever operations the theater commander needed them to do. And I took that position very seriously. I had an amazing background that allowed me to understand it and appreciate what my deployed boss was requiring of my boss as it relates to the capabilities of the submarine. And there's a report card. You know, if that submarine doesn't get her done, you know, my report card has a really ugly grade on it, and I get a phone call from my operational boss who says, "What the hell's going on there, Doug? How come your submarines aren't arriving in theater ready to do what we need them to do?" So there's a lot of pressure.
I'm sure.
And that's how they talk.
"Hey, Doug, what's going on with that?"
Didn't quite get there?
Yeah, there's not much yelling and screaming. You know, you don't need much of that at that level. It's just like, what the heck's going on? And when I was a squadron commander, we had Operation Desert Storm, and there were a lot of submarines involved in Tomahawk cruise missile launches into Iraq. So that was pretty heady stuff. You know, it just goes to show you got to show up. I don't think those COs realized what they were going to get into when they deployed, but you got to show up ready to fight.
What do you think, to kind of go back a little bit to that question I asked as far as leadership goes, what do you think, like, taught you that or prepared you for that? Like, did the military have official training in leadership? Or it just kind of, the story that you're telling just kind of seems like it just all kind of progressed and you were put in a role where you had to do that. You obviously had some natural ability. I mean, maybe you learned by example from your parents, or, you know, what do you think prepared you for that leadership type role?
Life prepared me. You know, back to growing up in Nebraska, you know, I it was a different time, I would say, than today. You know, I was like most teenage boys. I wanted some money in my pocket. And so I was willing to take jobs that, you know, I mean, I started making money detasseling corn. Okay, there's probably not a more challenging job than corn detasseling. The only thing that made it work for me is I was 14 when I started, okay? And back then in Nebraska, you couldn't get a job where they paid you a salary until you were age 16 or above. So I detasseled corn for 2 years. You know, I would say if you're detasseling corn with a crew, you're going to meet some salt of the earth people.
Yeah.
You know, and it teaches you things. Okay. And then I took a job working at a Dairy Queen when I turned 16, and I was fortunate enough. I had my sister's boyfriend work construction, and he asked me if I wanted to go to work doing what he was doing, which was putting shingles on houses. And I said, "Oh, hell yeah. How much does he pay?" And it was like double what I was making at Dairy Queen. But, you know, I'm not a big guy. I'm like 5'6", 5'7". Back then, I was probably 130 pounds soaking wet in a bundle of shingles. I got news for you. It weighed about 70 pounds.
Oh, shoot. Yep.
And so, you know, 21 square of shingles off the ground and onto the roof where they can be nailed into the roof, that damn near killed me. But, you know, I money's a great motivator.
Mm-hmm. And that money allowed you to go duck hunting, pheasant hunting.
Buy a shotgun.
There you go. You got that reward. And that was one of my first jobs, too, about 13, 14, was putting shingles on roofs and little farmhouses and stuff.
Yeah.
You develop a sense of balance like you wouldn't believe, throwing those tabs over your shoulder,
going
up a crickety ladder, and then flipping it over the top. You know, like, I know where you're coming from, because I'm not a big guy either, and I never was.
I think all that is a great point. You know, in everything that you do and all of these little things, these things that seem so significant or so insignificant or are just a grind that seem like it's nothing, like I just got to get through this. There's so many lessons to be pulled from those things. And that's, I think, what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you another job I had when I was just out of high school. I worked the mid shift at Campbell's Soup when there was a Campbell's Soup in downtown Omaha. And that was a great study in people too.
Yeah,
I mean, you had, you know, from age 55 all the way down to age 18, like I was, working the mid shift, which at Campbell's Soup back then there was no production. It was totally cleanup work.
Mm. Oh.
And so, you know, I learned a little bit about, you know, the production that goes into a can of soup. You probably wouldn't want to know what happens there.
What might fall in it.
But I worked with some great guys, and I got to know them. And they, you know, I was, again, a young kid. They looked out for me. I would say there were some definite challenges on the interpersonal side of things working at Campbell's Soup on the midwatch. You know, I'd go to work at like 11 o'clock and I'd get off at 7 when the day crew came in to make Campbell's Soup.
But I think that's something that we talk about, or you talk about a lot, is experience, right? Like, you don't have that knowledge if you've just not been through it or put in different situations. I mean, the kids have said that just with a random summer job, you know, like, oh, this person was blah, but I learned this. It's like, yeah.
And it's making the most of those experiences. It's recognizing that.
Mm-hmm. And then pushing on.
Yeah, and learning from it
and not quitting. Mm-hmm. Saying you didn't like it.
And for me, I don't know how you feel about it, but for me it puts you in some pretty difficult situations that you got to figure a way out of. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you don't have that experience, I think it's not like you can't be successful. Don't get me wrong,
right.
But certainly in the military, those skills served me well over the course of my career. And you know, I think even today in the role that I have, I think you have to be prepared to have tough conversations. A lot of people don't like it. It makes them feel uncomfortable. They don't want to engage in that sort of effort, but anything worthwhile is going to involve some tough conversations.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. So when you retired, you know, you get to the end of your military career, what were you doing there towards the end?
So my final job was, I was what's called the Commandant of the National War College. It's the most prestigious, college in the military. It's really a school that focuses on strategy, but it brings the whole of government together. Each of the individual services have their own strategy programs, but what they lack and what we had in spades at the National War College is we could bring the whole of government, because the school was in Washington, D.C. And it's developed a reputation, not because of me, but because of the fact that it's been in existence for over 100 years, of producing some of the best strategic minds in all of government, not just military. Mm-hmm. You have State Department. You have, you know, interagency people that work for the National Security Agency or the White House doing policy work as it relates to all of our allies around the world. And these people and the faculty there are just amazing because of their own experience, and they take their job very seriously, obviously.
Yeah.
And we bring in foreign students, which is remarkable because every class has about 34 foreign students from all over the world. It produces a learning and an exchange that can't be replicated anywhere.
What qualifies someone to go to that school? Like, is that something that you apply to, or are you asked to go to it, or how does that work?
Yeah, so there's not enough seats for everybody to get in. So I would say generally you have to be the very, very best in your service to get a seat there. And in government, you have to be the very, very most promising individual in whatever branch of government you work in. So obviously the people you're working with are just incredibly talented.
Mm-hmm.
And how long were you there for?
2 years.
Okay.
Before I retired from the military. Yeah. So, and I got to travel all over the world in that role because there's both an in-school element and then a travel element of that. So places like Uzbekistan, wouldn't put that on your top 10 list if I were you. I got nothing against Uzbekistan. I just it's kind of in a sporty neighborhood is what I would say.
Yeah, the restaurant scene isn't so good.
Yeah, it's actually just north. It shares a border with Afghanistan.
Oh.
It's a former Soviet state. No longer. It's an independent country now, but they lean pretty heavily. It's towards the Soviet style.
Okay.
And now, because of the situation in Afghanistan, you probably wouldn't want to travel there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like, you're a student there, or you were a teacher?
No, I was the commandant, so I ran the war college.
But then you're asking how to be a student.
No, I just asked, like, how do they decide who goes there?
Yeah, it's pretty selective, is what I was telling Ben.
You know,
there's only the.
But selective for, like, the teachers and selective for the students.
Oh, I'm not going to say selective for the teachers.
Oh, but, come on.
But I would say for the students, it was.
For sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, but they obviously, you were handpicked as. Mm-hmm. Teachers,
yeah,
too.
I mean, you know, we've got all these prestigious graduates. You know, most of them go on to, you know, very, very – the military, I would say, very, very impactful positions inside their military service. Like, I'll give you an example. You may not know who this fella is, but he was really the hero, I would say, of the Iraq War, a guy named David Petraeus. Army general. Mm-hmm. He's a graduate of the National War College.
Okay.
And see, that's a gift that keeps on giving because those people think a lot about the time they spent there.
Uh-huh.
And they're always willing to come back and engage the students.
Which is
really amazing.
Yeah.
Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He is a graduate of the National War College, and he was – I interacted with him quite a bit. He was always very, very generous with his time and spent a lot of time with the students.
Have we ever had a president attend that school?
You know, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But the school was created by Teddy Roosevelt.
Okay.
So he's considered the father of the National War College.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, there have been some very, very influential military personnel who've caused the college to evolve.
Yeah.
It's an amazing building. It's an historic landmark. It's called Bro Arts, which is a, you know, if you're an architect, you understand what that is. But it's a very just amazing building to be in.
Huh.
Interesting.
Sounds really
painted
cool.
Ceilings. You know, you know, it's just, it's been upgraded over the years because the mechanical HVAC systems in there had to be sure. upgraded, but. Yeah, it hasn't changed greatly and never will.
Right, on purpose. Yeah,
because they're not going to let anybody really touch the building.
It's not a history.
Yeah, they is the historic architects of the National Capital Region. They won't allow anybody to mess it up.
Right, yeah.
So what I think what to wrap it up with, I wanted to just touch on too. So you made it to retirement. And, you know, decided to move on for whatever reason. I'm sure that was somewhat tough.
Now you're just sitting around eating bonbons. And...
Well, I mean, everybody's got to retire. That's part of the proposition. You can't serve forever.
Oh, kidding.
Yeah.
You're busy now.
Yeah.
So what have you gone on to do today and how long has that been?
Yeah. So I took a job with a big architecture engineering firm. I won't use the name. You can probably figure it out because I'm going to give you enough clues. if you're really interested in knowing who I work for, you can figure that out. Based in Omaha, and that was kind of a what I would call a serendipitous moment. I used to come back as a flag officer in the Navy to do what we refer to inside the Navy as Navy Days. And it's really a chance for the Navy to come back to communities that have sponsored a lot of men and women into the Navy and thank them for their support.
Okay.
And I was, one of the few flag officers inside the Navy that was that had Nebraska roots. So I frequently came back and supported that. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to this company and I did it, I think, twice, maybe only once. I'd have to think a little bit harder about that. But I attracted the attention of one of the senior leaders. And, I was fortunate enough to be offered a position with the company. And I've been doing that for the last, it's 11 going on 12 years now.
Okay.
And it's architecture engineering.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of roadway, a lot of water-related, wastewater, drinking water. It's what we refer to in the industry as horizontal construction. Roads, bridges, mm-hmm. pipelines, all those things. And but our architecture practice, which we're really proud of collectively, is we are the number one healthcare architecture firm in the U.S., which is a pretty amazing accomplishment. So we build – and I've been fortunate enough to be involved in some very, very significant military healthcare projects, which I get a big kick out of. I tell people you don't want to be faint of heart when it comes to building a modern hospital because they are extremely complicated.
Yeah.
And so it's been great for me. I'm not signing and sealing drawings, as we say in the business. You wouldn't want me designing a bridge or designing a roadway. I'm really there to guide the company's efforts as it relates to federal clients.
That's kind of back to that role we talked about kind of towards the end of your military career. So in leadership and directing things and making sure it all goes the way it's supposed to go, people motivated, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so if somebody needs their hat pounded flat, they call me.
yeah.
Or wants to pound a hat flat. Like, and I'm just being fun. Cute.
Yeah.
We do great work as a company. Mm-hmm. We're very proud of the work we do. We're employee owned. That creates this camaraderie that you can't replicate, I would say, in a publicly owned company.
Yeah.
Where you got the outside investors sort of driving the day to day. So
how long do you think you'll be doing that for?
It's a good question. I get asked that a lot. My hair is not as brown as it used to be.
Stop.
People say, geez, Doug, when are you going to call it a day?
Yeah, like when are you sick of traveling?
I like to throw it back at them and say, well, what are you talking about? What is there something you want to share with me?
Should I be? Yeah.
Should I be? Yeah. Yeah. You know how some people are just pretty structured and planned. I didn't know if you're like, oh, at this age, I'm, you know.
Well, Morgan, you know, the thing that I struggle with is what the hell am I going to do if I...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, like, you like to stay busy, obviously, and keep your brain moving and engaged.
Yeah. I'd find something I don't know, and I'm going to have to, right? I mean, you know, it's just going to happen.
I mean, you could just start hunting again.
Right, go hunting. if there were any pheasants left in Nebraska, I wouldn't mind going hunting.
Well, Andy?
We can get them on some.
Yeah, just not close to here, but definitely get up north and Andy's stomping around or something.
Yeah.
Where's that at? Where'd you grow up?
Little farm up in Boyd County, so north central. You know where O'Neill, Norfolk is?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, north of Norfolk, about an hour and a half.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That was one of Ashley's. I married a biologist, science teacher, mm-hmm. and her capstone project when she was getting her master's in biology was this project we did reintroducing pheasants on our ranch.
Wow.
And it was really fascinating. It was basically a two-year type of ordeal, and we used different ways to try and do it and, you know, monitored it all, and it works.
They're still there.
Yeah, there's birds there, and when I was growing up, there was no birds.
So you drove in from Boyd County this morning?
No.
Okay. I was going to say, you deserve a reward if that was the case. No.
He lives here now.
Yep, I'm on the other side of the lake from these guys.
Okay, got it. But you still have a ranch up there?
Yeah.
Good. Yep. You run cattle?
Not a lot. We majority of what we do is lease.
Okay.
Cash rent.
Right.
To neighboring ranchers and stuff.
So was it a family ranch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Ben and Joel are going to go on a hunt up there soon.
Andy's going up there this next weekend and taking the boys out. And
okay. How many acres?
Just over 2,000.
Wow.
So
it's a lot.
Yeah. So I still remember 640 acres is a square mile.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure it's not square probably, right?
It's not square.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool, kind of like around here. We're right there in what's known as the Missouri Valley. So 7 miles north of our ranch is the Missouri River.
Mm-hmm.
7 miles to the south of us is the Niobrara River. Mm-hmm. And we have creeks and ponds and everything else. It's really hilly.
Yeah.
So like when people were saying Nebraska's flat growing up, I'm like, what are you guys talking about? Like I didn't understand what people were getting at.
Yeah.
But yeah, just go down I-80. I get it.
That's it. That's exactly it. Most people only see Nebraska from Interstate 80. So you can understand that a little bit.
Yeah.
But I've never spent any time up there.
Well, come on out.
But I am fascinated by the sandhill cranes and their migration.
Yeah.
You must get a pretty good seat for that up where you live.
Oh, yeah. Last time we were up there, they're so loud.
Yeah.
And you're looking around, where are they? And you look up, and they're just little dots, and that's how loud they are.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's kind of cool when you think about it like that. That kind of thing going on there, and it's pretty unique to that area of the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk to somebody like Doug who's been around the world and seen like some really crazy stuff,
mm-hmm.
and he's fascinated by that.
Right.
You know, what's going on in like small area of Nebraska. So if you think about it, we got some pretty cool stuff around here.
Well, you do.
Think about it. I mean, people come from around the world to see that migration, and it's fascinating. I've only seen videos of it. It's got to be incredible.
Mm-hmm. Just thousands and thousands. Even like the stargazer stuff that goes on in Valentine, Nebraska. I mean, last time I was out there filming a little bit, there's people from Japan, China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, traveling from the other side of the world just to see the stars.
Yeah.
Here
in Nebraska.
Because you don't have any light pollution out
there.
You know, it's...
Yep. And then, that's why I was there covering the battle that's still going on with wind turbines. And they're trying to put wind turbines up with the blinking, you know, lights and all that other stuff.
Yep.
And people around there are like, no, you're not.
Well, your wife, you said, was a biologist?
Yeah.
She can tell you how many bird takes there are with those wind turbines.
Ooh, you're getting into some. Oh. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
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 And the microclimate that they develop underneath. Yeah, there's some things going on there.
We ain't got time for all that.
No, we don't. Well, it's another podcast.
Yeah, that's probably politics that we don't want to delve into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Doug, has been fun, man. It's good getting to know you. And
yeah.
we thank you for your service. Yeah. Got a cool story.
Gosh, thank you.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I know there's a lot more to that we could definitely dig into.
Well, thanks for having me. You guys have been great, and it's been a great conversation, and good luck with the future podcasts.
Yeah.
I was thinking you got to do this every week, so you got to come up with.
We do. Yep.
Yeah. We just hit our 100th episode.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A couple ago, so mm-hmm. I mean yep. we're
2 years into it
and yep. deep here, can't quit now.
It's like anything else, you know. I mean, what we were talking about earlier in the podcast, you know, stuff isn't always what you think it's going to be, and you got to get in and you got to do the work. Mm-hmm. And stick with it, and that's what we've done. But it has been fun. Mm-hmm. There's times when it's like, oh man, we got to get in there and do that again. But it's great, you know. Yeah. It pays off. So
this was interesting.
Yeah,
I just like stories, and so you always have lots of good stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I stayed out of classified things. I think we straight at 1 point.
I know. If only we could get you there.
When we shut the mics off, we'll get into that.
Yeah. I got some conspiracy theories I want to talk to the guy. Maybe that's the next podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
With Doug. I'm just going to warn you, you're not going to get much out of me.
He's taking it to the grave, okay? Yeah. Well, thanks,
All right.
Doug.
All right, yeah. Anything else? No?
No.
All right. Let's close it out.
Later.